It's great to have your company. You're listening to Life and Faith from the Centre for Public Christianity. My name's Simon Smart.
And I'm Justine Toe.
Well, our guest today, Ross Piper, has had an interesting, very eclectic career that includes working for a major bank, also some mining companies. But he's also had two stints working overseas for World Vision in aid and development. Firstly, as country director for World Vision in Montenegro, running programs for working with refugees from Kosovo and the war in Bosnia. More recently, Ross and his family spent 4 years living in Cyprus, running the operations for World Vision in Eastern Europe and Middle East. His experience in the NGO sector is vast and fascinating. I remember a time, Ross, you told me you worked with Hugh Jackman. We might get to that later. He's got plenty of stories to tell. He's in the studio to talk about it. Welcome, Ross.
Thanks, Simon.
Can you give us a sense of what you were doing day to day in both the Cyprus job at World Vision and perhaps earlier in Montenegro?
I think in many ways, the work that I was doing there is similar to any kind of leadership or management role that you'd find in an organization. Clearly, there's a level of complexity and volatility in the environments that you face in some of these countries, particularly if they're either active conflict or post-conflict. But it's similar to running any sort of organization, hiring, firing of staff, management of finances, logistics, programs, etc. Lots of external liaison with government and other stakeholders as well.
And what is it that about this particular kind of work that keeps drawing you back to it?
There was a strong alignment of passion and purpose and vocation. And I think the skills and the experience that I'd had both in the corporate sector and the nonprofit sector brought me to a point, and also with our family, where we were keen to be engaged and spending our time in something where the bottom line was not so much about making shareholders wealthier, but hopefully to be able to run and build good programs that had a longer-term impact.
The couple of places you've worked in overseas are war-torn places in many cases. What would you say are the most obvious impacts of war on the people you've worked with there?
I think particularly in that part of the world, Eastern Europe, the Middle East and Central Asia as well, where you have active conflict, it's very visible. You have all the things that you would normally see and the horrendous impacts of massive dislocation of populations, armed conflicts and so forth. But particularly in Eastern Europe, the type of impacts I think are more subtle, and what you often see then is a brokenness of communities. And so the sort of poverty that you see there is not the African type of poverty where there's chronic levels of hunger and so forth, but it's an absence of hope. It's a fracturing of communities. And so in the case of the Balkans, you had communities that had coexisted for a number of generations that, as a result of the conflict, end up being fractured and tremendous dislocation as a result of that.
Ross, can you give us a sense of the most confronting things that you've encountered and how you kind of respond to them?
Once again, I think it depends a lot on the context. The immediate example that comes to mind is Afghanistan, where World Vision and many other agencies have large programs. I used to travel to Afghanistan two or three times a year when I was in Cyprus, and we have probably 600 or 700 staff there, local staff, a couple of expat staff as well, working in the most remarkably challenging circumstances, both in terms of what those staff themselves have experienced, but equally the context that they're actually operating in. And paradoxically, these are the places where often you see the greatest level of hope. So in a place like Afghanistan, it's very raw. We had a very large midwifery program in Afghanistan where we were training young midwives in home birth delivery. Afghanistan's probably the worst country in the world to be born, particularly a female, but just generally horrendous levels of infant mortality. But to meet some of the frontline midwives who were living, working in these communities, they themselves having experienced incredible hardship, and yet being able to leverage knowledge and a very small level of expertise to a great and profound lasting impact, I think is something that always used to move me. Other places, it's more subtle than that. So in countries that have moved from conflict into a state where they're now transitioning economies, like the Caucasus, Azerbaijan, Georgia, Armenia, these countries have a different sort of poverty. And it's, once again, it's that lack of hope, disaffected youth, huge diaspora. Nobody wants to stay in these countries because they see little opportunity or hope there.
Ross, you went to places like Gaza. That must have been a bit of a shock even for you, who's seen a bit of this sort of stuff going on.
Yeah, particularly last year after the most recent conflict in Gaza. I think quite profound, like nothing I've seen before, actually, in terms of the levels of destruction. Now, clearly in a place like Gaza, there's complexity. The rights and wrongs of the situation are profound and there are multiple layers to it. But just visually to go into a place like that and to see a community basically flattened. Interestingly, too, though, where you see the greatest despair, you equally see the hope. And some people may have heard of, there's a group in Gaza who do parkour. Now, parkour is this French urban dance or urban gymnastics, I guess.
I haven't had a go at it yet.
You're never too young to try parkour. In Gaza, there's a group there who actually, in the midst of the rubble, are well known for doing the most remarkable acrobatics. And so when I was there, we were able to watch this group and we took photos and so forth. And so, yeah, I'm always struck by this notion of where you find the greatest darkness, you equally see, you see light and you see hope and you see resilience.
Yeah, give us some more examples of that, because especially when you're looking at, in your case, World Vision, implementing some programs. Tell us about the ways in which you've seen it make a real difference to individuals' lives, but also communities.
Yeah, it's a great question. Firstly, I'd say that aid and development is, it's like an industry. It's an industry just as is banking or construction. And, you know, when we first went abroad to Montenegro, we were fairly green, somewhat naive. I'd worked in the mining industry prior to that. And the first thing that really shook us was realizing that this is a business. I'm not saying that's a bad thing, but I think any notion of, I suppose, a sense of idealism that because everyone is there to help, and they are there to help, that therefore means that everything will be done well or professionally, you very quickly realise that you need to act in a very shrewd manner, you need to manage politics well, you need to be good stewards with the resources that you actually have. And so I remember my wife Sarah and I, within the first week we'd arrived in Montenegro, and this was just after the Kosovo crisis, but we sat in an interagency meeting where they bring together all the NGOs, non-government organisations who'd come to respond to the crisis there. And it was really, it made the UN Security Council look tame. I mean, you had the Italian faction, the French faction, the Americans were there. In fact, we were graced with the presence of a group not well known, but big on reputation, known as the Texan Clowns for Peace. And they were very vocal in the meeting. And so you literally had all of these different groups, all of them well-intentioned, all of them trying to make a difference, but realizing very quickly that you needed to be able to lead well and to engage well for all of these organizations to be able to contribute well. Having said that, you know, I'm a great believer in the importance of good aid and development, and can think across the region and the experience and the exposures that we had where we saw programs that had quite profound differences, one of which would be in Pakistan, for example, where we had a program, actually was funded by the Australian government, that ran a drop-in centre for street children. And these kids in a context like Pakistan are really the lowest of the low, eking out a survival from, you know, ages of, you know, 4 or 5, they're on the streets begging and so forth. But to be able to bring these children into a setting of non-formal education, learning basic skills around hygiene and so forth, with an end result that they would then be mainstreamed into education. So these things don't actually cost a lot of money, but the impacts both socially and economically are quite profound.
If you've just joined us, you're listening to Life and Faith from the Centre for Public Christianity. We're talking today with Ross Piper. He's talking about his experiences working overseas in the aid and development sector.
Ross, can you talk about how your faith plays into all of this, and that idea that you were saying earlier that you didn't want to work in an industry that was solely about, you know, making profits, but you wanted to see lasting change. How does your faith sort of play into that?
Yeah, as a Christian, clearly World Vision is a Christian organisation. There are many other faith-based NGOs that are out there, and so clearly my faith is a foundational point of reference in terms of the work that we do. But equally, I was challenged when I was in particularly the most recent role in engaging with a lot of interfaith work and different communities. I mentioned Afghanistan earlier, where 99% of our staff are Muslim staff, but they themselves ascribe great value to working for a faith-based organisation. And paradoxically, it was probably our Muslim staff who were the greatest defenders of the Christian identity of the organisation, which is a narrative you would never hear. And so, you know, I think there's enormous commonality when you look at the needs of the vulnerable and the most oppressed. Clearly, from a Christian faith perspective, that resonates very strongly with the life and the teachings of Jesus Christ, but equally from a Muslim perspective. And so finding this area of commonality where we would sit with some of the leaders in the faith leaders, the mullahs in communities in Afghanistan, for example, where one I recall in particular, where he said, we prayed for help and Allah brought world vision to us. And so you realise that there's a narrative and there's a commonality here that you never hear played out in the media. Faith is a defining point, and it's been a defining point in the conflict in many of these communities as well, particularly in that region where literally you have the intersection point of the great faiths of the world. And so if we don't understand or embrace or engage development practice around that faith, we're missing a major element of what makes communities actually function.
Ross, what have you learned about human nature as you've watched people endure terrible struggle and sometimes, you know, thrive in that environment too? But have you picked up things that you perhaps didn't know before you went?
Yeah, absolutely. I think there is a remarkable resilience. You know, I think about the communities and the countries that I was privileged to be able to work in. Even take Lebanon as an example. Now, Lebanon gets a bit of a bad rap in many respects, but, you know, find me another country on the earth that can absorb almost a third of its population again in refugees and still be opening their homes. And so you realise that where there is adversity, there is also remarkable resilience and strength.
Gosh, Ross, you're just mentioning all these different countries. I'm sure there's another country in store for us with this next question. You've been involved in microfinance. Mm. Is that the kind of model you favour when it comes to the kind of work that can create lasting change and impact communities in that great way?
Absolutely. Look, I think there's a spectrum of interventions in terms of aid and development, and there's a time and a place where you need the emergency, give me blankets, shelter, food, water, etc. But lasting development, sustainable development, clearly microfinance and the models around that are a strongly favourable way to be working. I think the delivery of aid in many respects, to use the language of business, the return on investment in microfinance is something that is quite profound. And I've seen the empowerment that comes through individuals' lives where someone is no longer taking a handout, but rather taking a commercial loan on commercial terms, but in a way that actually enables them to take a step up. And I can think of countless examples where someone would start by borrowing enough money to buy a cow. They come back 6 months later and can buy two cows and then four cows, and the whole community actually, the economic situation of the community benefits. So yes, absolutely is the right way, but the context has to be right in terms of a level of stability within the country itself.
I've heard that microfinancing is particularly a way to empower women. Have you found that in your experience?
Yeah, absolutely. Statistically, they say that loans that are taken by women, if you look at the well-being of children, which is ultimately what you're trying to affect in a positive way, there's a number of qualitative and quantitative measures in terms of that child well-being impact are profoundly stronger where there is a female as the main recipient of the loan. And clearly there's a range of social and other factors around that, but it's a metric that's actually tracked in the industry as well because the correlation is so strong.
And lastly, Ross, what do you think Westerners gain from an experience like the ones you've had in these places and in this sort of aid and development?
I think the best thing that Westerners can gain is an appreciation of the tremendous capacity that exists in the developing world. Any notion that we were somehow the experts coming in to tell people what to do is very quickly disbanded when you realise the vast majority of people you're working with are far more capable, often far better educated. I bristle with the notion of let's call it poverty tourism, or I don't think that's the right thing. And I also think that in many respects, the whole dynamic between the way aid organisations work now, there's been tremendous growth, but also tremendous, let's say, professionalisation, where it's no longer seen as kind of a jaunt that someone takes a step out for a year or two to feel good about themselves and then come back to do the real work. Quite the opposite. And so you're dealing with multi-million dollar programs, all of the complexity and risks that go with those things. And therefore, I think there's a profound opportunity for professionals working in places like Australia or elsewhere to come into these contexts and to apply those skills well. So I think professionally and personally, and for me, I'd have to say going back to World Vision after a period working in an investment bank was absolutely life-giving. Sarah, my wife, would tell you, she'll say, Ross, you woke up again.
Well, you've had some amazing experiences. Ross, it might be time for you to write your book, I think. We'll get you back in when you do that, but it's so good to get to talk about that. Thanks so much.
And we'll get that chapter in on Hugh Jackman there.
Yes.
You've been listening to Life and Faith from the Centre for Public Christianity. For more on this topic and many more besides, go to publicchristianity.org.